everyone, to Opening Dharma Access, a podcast where we hear stories from BIPOC teachers about their Dharma experiences and practice and how these inform the ways they are sharing the Dharma today. I am Reverend Lin, your host for this episode, as Sister Peace needed to attend to some family business. Today we have Joe Riley. He is a singer, songwriter, social worker, and ordained Dharma teacher in the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh. Joe was raised Catholic and currently studies and practices progressive Catholicism, Native American spirituality, and engaged Buddhism. Joe has been a student of Zen Master Thich Nhat Hanh since 2004 and is often found singing and writing songs on spiritual retreats. He currently lives on Wauwinyatanyong, otherwise known as Detroit, where he co-leads the Building Beloved Community Sangha. He is of Cherokee, Choctaw, Italian, and Irish descent, and identifies as Native American. So first, maybe you can just correct my pronunciation of the indigenous land there in Detroit.
Thanks, Reverend Leon. Wauwinyatanyong is how I say it, but I don't know if that's the most accurate either, and there's different dialects. That's in Anishinaabemowin, the indigenous land of the Great Lakes here where I live.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. Thank you for that. Also for really, you know, working with us to do this pivot for this interview.
Yeah, you're welcome. And I want to just ask us all to send loving energy to dear Sister Peace and her sister and family. And just sending that loving kindness to them, because Sister Peace is very much with us still in this interview.
Yes, for sure. Yes, let's take a minute. All right. Well, once again, welcome. And besides what you've shared in the bio, are there other categories of social location that are of importance to you right now that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I think just living in Detroit, a place where we see a lot of the, challenges of our time amplified, certainly of our economy, and a place with a lot of disparity all around. And so I didn't grow up here, so I'm still kind of an outsider, but I've been, an adopted child of Detroit. And so to just put it into that context for those who are outside of Detroit or Metro Detroit, we're going through a lot of gentrification here in the city and a lot of displacement of folks who have lived here a long time and who are of lower income. And there's continued environmental justice concerns here in the city, too, with higher rates of health problems from air pollution and other things. So just to let folks know, like, that's part of where I'm coming from too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally relate in the San Francisco Bay Area similarly. In fact, we just had, I don't know if made national news, but Oakland Port of Oakland just had a recycling fire, a metal recycling plant. And of course, air pollution, and and it seemed like, oh, we should do something now. And they have some activists have been going, we've been talking about this for like 40 years, you mm-hmm. know, and mm-hmm. one just happened last year too, you know, so every time it becomes a news issue, and it's been an ongoing thing for sure.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. No, I hadn't heard of that specific instance, but I know that there are similar struggles in communities throughout the country.
So you said you weren't raised there. How long have you been in Detroit?
I've been here on and off over the last maybe 25 years since I was a student at University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, which is just about 45 minutes drive west of Detroit.
I see.
I grew up in Kalamazoo, Michigan, which is a small city halfway between Detroit and Chicago. And then, have been living here on and off for the past 25 years.
Right. And then the interview is a pivot. I saw you're a social worker. Right now I don't do social work. I just teach. But, what kind of social work do you do, or are you still doing it?
Well, I've always worked with youth in different capacities. That's what inspired me to go back to school and get my MSW, which was now 10 years ago already, which is crazy. But I'd worked for a long time with our urban Indian community here in Detroit. There's a youth program that's centered around traditional culture and alcohol, drug, suicide prevention, mm-hmm. called the Dream Seekers Youth Program. And I actually helped the youth there write songs. We made a couple albums. You can find them online, and a couple of videos too. You could find on my YouTube channel with the Dream Seekers. So that was my work for a long time. And then I've worked also with elders, folks in assisted living homes, doing therapeutic arts and music. And then most recently, the last few years, I've been in schools. So in two different schools. Currently, I'm teaching music and doing community social work and family resource social work with the James and Grace Lee Boggs School, which is a school here in Detroit, a charter school now in our 11th year that was started by students of James and Grace Lee Boggs, who are lifetime activists here in Detroit. I was fortunate enough to meet Grace. I never knew Jimmy. He had passed by the time I got to Detroit, but I did know Grace for a number of years and had the fortune to work with her in the Detroit Summer program that she helped to start. And so to work at that school is a really great continuation of her legacy and both her and James's legacy. And it's a big part of my practice to sharing the practice with kids and sharing music with kids.
Yeah. Oh, that's so great. So you have been practicing, I'm not sure it was teaching or practicing since 2004 with Thich Nhat Hanh. So it was part of your training to become a teacher from your work with these youths and or seniors?
It was part of it. You know, it's all, as Ty says, inter is. We all inter be. And so all of this, as my path has unfolded, is an extension of my spiritual vocation and calling in terms of how best to serve. Mm-hmm. And that's a question that came through from my time practicing with Ty and the Sangha around, they really are supportive of helping folks identify what is your spiritual aspiration, what is your deepest desire, mm-hmm. and to find ways to serve that are healing for myself as well as for others is a big part of that for me. And that has often included music, writing and sharing music, and working with youth and families and building community. Yeah, I was lucky to first be introduced to Ty and the Plum Village Sangha at their very first, back then it was just POC retreat. Mm-hmm. That was at Deer Park Monastery in Escondido, California, mm-hmm. in 2004. And the woman I was dating at the time was already connected there, and she invited me. And it was just such a heart-opening, you know, growthful experience personally. I had mm-hmm. really looked for, I guess, communities of color and spiritual communities of color, and also just for help with my own suffering, especially around anxiety and depression, particularly anxiety. And so to encounter Thay and the Sangha and the Dharma around healing was just so impactful for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that I would have done it if it wasn't a POC specific retreat. So I think that's a big, you know, in terms of answering the question of how could we be more supportive for BIPOC practitioners and teachers? Mm-hmm. That's a big part of it for me, is creating those spaces where we know we can feel safe, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Especially for folks who are just starting out in the practice. Mm-hmm. I feel like now that I'm solid enough in my own practice, I can feel safe in all different environments. However, I still feel the most safe when it's a mixed group, you know, when it's BIPOC and white folks together, or when it's just all BIPOC folks. Mm-hmm. When it is a majority white space, that can feel challenging still for me. Mm-hmm. But they're all opportunities to practice. But I think especially starting out, having that space just for people of color or BIPOC folks was really crucial for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I have some Vietnamese American friends here who went to that first, who, you know, I actually, when I moved to San Francisco Bay Area, for the reason of finding Vietnamese American community, as I don't know if you know, but San Jose is the largest Vietnamese, besides Orange County, okay. Vietnamese American community in the United States. And so anyway, first I connected with all the Vietnamese community, and in particular, there was like a queer Vietnamese conference, the first ever, wow. when I first moved here in 95. And so I started out with them chanting in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition. We'd meet every month to chant the precepts. Interestingly, so yeah, they went to that first one, and I didn't have the opportunity at the time. So yeah, it's just really interesting, all these, you know, connections, and how yeah. it points to important it is when these large institutions of Buddhism that are in outside of specific, I'll just say heritage or Asian and diaspora Buddhism groups, when these big institutions have these BIPOC groups, it is like a magnet for many of us. And so around that, when you say that you still feel more, I can't remember the word you use,
safe,
yes, mm-hmm. in BIPOCs or mixed groups, can you say more about that, and what aspects of that informs how you teach when you teach BIPOC groups?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, first of all, I should premise this by saying I'm very much a baby Dharma teacher. I only received the lamp in 2021. So I'm very new at being at this role of actually teaching formally, mm-hmm. but, and so I'm still learning as I go. And, but I think for me, yeah, being raised in the US as someone of both European and Native ancestry, mm-hmm. and understanding the history of colonization and the continued effects and policies that are still oppressive in our country, as well as not just policies, but overall consciousness around Indigenous rights and around racial equity. Mm-hmm. I think for me, and also, you know, approaching a spiritual space, it does need to be safe. Like, we are at a place of a lot of vulnerability. We are bringing our broken hearts, our woundedness, our traumas, our suffering. And we need a container that is safe to hold that without causing further harm. Mm-hmm. And that's really rare. That can be hard to find. Even within our Native communities, there can be, people who exploit the spiritual practices or traditions as ways of hurting one another. And I've experienced that too. And certainly within Catholicism and Christianity, that's how I grew up. That's how I was raised. We're much more aware now of the ways that the Catholic Church has harmed folks through sexual abuse, but also the history of boarding schools and other colonization efforts. And so, with coming from just that context, being born here in the U.S., a place that has so much unresolved racial trauma, I feel most safe when there's a group of folks who are already committed to doing their own work around that, around healing, and who are comfortable and acquainted with mixing beyond their own racial group. And so, you know, when there's a group that's mostly white or all white, it can feel like I don't have space to be fully seen or to be myself fully. And I've, you know, part of my own work is to look at that and to see what is that really all about, in myself, and to reconcile in myself those different pieces of myself that might feel in conflict. But yeah, in terms of community and spiritual community, I always have just felt more at home when there's a nice mix of folks from different racial backgrounds, different gender identities, different sexual orientations. I just feel more at home in that than a more homogenous kind of community. You asked also, like, in terms of my teaching, how do I approach that? I'm still learning that. And with our Sangha that I'm co-leading, I don't want to make it just a BIPOC Sangha. Like, I want to keep it open while also centering folks who live in Detroit and folks who are BIPOC. And so that has, it has pushed some white people away who have said, like, they felt like it was not welcoming to them. Which is hard as a leader too. I want to make sure it's really fully inclusive, but while also navigating the realities of the racial disparities and traumas that we're all carrying, you know? So I'm still really learning. I have a lot to learn, but I want our Sangha to be cultivated as a place where all people can feel safe. And I know in order to do that, it's got to be centered in what works for me and what counters the dominant culture's kind of racial hierarchy, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. I think a way that I see it is we have to decenter white supremacy culture.
There you go.
And part of that is recentering to where the dominant view used to be white centered and white easeful. And so we want to basically, just since I was part of the Buddhists of color caretaker, one of the few people of color group in the Bay Area in the mid-90s, right? The whole point is to bring in more views. I think that's the thing that we've been stressing, and I think keep on needing to be stressed. It isn't we're taking away the white view. I think that we are decentering it, and really we're just making it more inclusive views. We're bringing in more views. So the thing is to open up to more views, which is part of skillful view, as far as I understand it, right? The first of the Eightfold Path. So really, it's just opening up our views to more and more views. And unfortunately, for some people, that is threatening. And I think it's the overall liberation of Buddha's practice to open up our views. So on a certain level, we're... What's the word I'm looking for? We're basically emphasizing the liberation aspect of practice, of skillful view.
Yes.
And with that, the understanding of how dukkha arises when we're not willing to open up our minds.
Yes. I think that's a really good way to put it. And in terms of liberation, that we want all beings to be liberated, including white people. And that white people are oppressed as well within the confines of white supremacy. Mm-hmm. That even the construction of whiteness is something that I think needs to be dismantled and looked at, because it contributes to this system that we're all in. Yeah, how do we liberate all beings? Mm-hmm. And part of that, yes, is being more inclusive of all beings and all people, and not having a white majority. I think it's challenging. In my experience, Buddhist communities in the U.S. tend to be more, at least this is in the my own tradition, in Plum Village tradition, it tends to be more older, white, middle and upper class folks, you know, who have the resources to go on retreats and take time to practice. And that's what I want to continue to evolve the community. You know, I want to continue to be part of the broadening, the deepening of the community, so that really the Dharma can reach all folks, not just the people in our society who have been more privileged than others.
Mm-hmm. Have more access. Sure. I think it's a theme at this time, and an opportunity for shift and liberation for a lot of these communities that thus far have been most accessible to white bodies. And so, do you want to say anything more about your teaching, perhaps around how music helps to make it more inclusive? And is there a song? Sister Peace told me to make sure that you bring your guitar and
share a song
with us. Yeah. So.
Music is very inclusive, and it is a universal language, and it is the way that I feel like I can best transmit the Dharma is through music. And that's what was transmitted to me through both of my parents. I grew up with them singing, and playing guitar, and they would sing a lot in church growing up. So kind of like, I call it Catholic folk music. Mm-hmm. And so they really transmitted to me this way of communicating love, communicating spiritual expression through music. And so that's really the best way that I can do it as well. The songs that I write, I want them to be universal, where I can, and I do sing them at Buddhist places, but also at Christian places or Jewish places or secular places. And it can still make sense, you know, and native communities. I don't think I've sung at a Muslim community, but I would if I was invited, you know, like just to the way that music communicates something across these lines that we create as humans, mm-hmm. so that can separate us or make us feel separate. Mm-hmm. So yeah, music is a big unifying force that I've experienced for sure.
And I, honestly, I don't, you know, I don't know the history of much about, except for reading Sister Chan Kam's book, Learning True Love, and how they, she and then bringing in Thich Nhat Hanh developed the Engaged Buddhism for the youth group there in Vietnam, but how it translated to the U.S. But I was at one of the first, as far as I know, a Bay Area visits at Spirit Rock before the retreat center was even built, where 2,000 people showed up, and they wow. had and forgive me, I don't remember who it was. You know, sing a song. Singing was always seemed to be a part of the Thich Nhat Hanh community in the U.S. Again, my point in bringing up the book is I don't remember it being a part of it in Vietnam, and maybe it has to do with the, you know, they were doing in the midst of the war. So it seems like you found a good Buddhist lineage that has incorporated songs. Was that part of what resonated for you? Were there, I presume there were songs at that POC retreat.
Yes, there were. And they had a be-in where I got to share a song too. And and really felt the support of the community in creating songs and music and uh-huh. sharing. So yes, that's been a big part of my connection to the Plum Village community for sure. Yeah.
All right. And I think it's a good time now to see if you'd like to share a song with us.
Sure. Yeah. Breathing in, I am alive right here. Breathing out, my mind is clear. Breathing in, my body is at ease. Breathing out, I am at peace. Breathing. Empty out your pockets, no enlightenment here. Just a pair of brown eyes and some meditation gear. It's clear we are something much more than what's sold on TV or bought in a store. We are stores of seeds, deep and wise. We are all of the oceans. Just look in your eyes, see the vastness of the sea, all the elements, the beat flowing through you and me. Let go and be free and breathe. Mm-hmm. Breathing in, I am alive right here. Breathing out, my mind is clear. Breathing in, my body is at ease. Breathing out, I am at peace. Breathing. Be free of our perceptions, so many misconceptions and wrong notions. Didn't you hear? We are all of the oceans, the waves, the rocks, and the clouds. We are the water droplets gently falling down and returning to the sky. I'm learning to ask why we're yearning just to try to breathe. Breathing in, I am alive right here. Breathing out, my mind is clear. Breathing in, my body is at ease. Breathing out, I am at peace. There are so many reasons to be happy in There are so many reasons to give thanks, and there are so many reasons to be happy, to give my broom. I'm dancing with the moon. I will be dreaming soon, but for now I'm wide awake, sitting still like a lake with some wild rice growing. It's really nice knowing who I really am, who we really are. Sometimes I can't forget when I'm driving in my car. It's time to pull over, didn't go very far. Try walking on the earth, you might think that sounds bizarre. I think it's rather funny to let go of my money and be one with the energy that flows in me and around me. And so I just surround me with flowers and poetry, beautiful verses. So when my mind disperses, I remember we've rehearsed this to not get caught in the cycle of birth and death. I really don't know about that, so I'll just follow my breath. Follow my breath. Follow your breath with me. Breathing in, I am alive right here. Breathing out, my mind is clear. Breathing in, my body is at ease. Breathing out, I am at peace.
Mr. Peace was like, make sure he has his guitar. I have to say, I took deep breaths while my foot was tapping. And then at one point, my skin was all like alive and tingling. So worked on me. Thank you. Thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Tell me how this came to you. Or anything you want to say about the creative aspect, or, you know, was it the words, was it the music, or whatever? Yeah.
That song came to me on retreat at Plum Village with Ty and the Sangha many years ago now. And it's become writing process as part of my practice. The songs come to me when I can be in a calm place, when I have the spaciousness and the support of other practitioners to just let go of my daily responsibilities, to really be present with myself and with the breath and with the spirit and the earth and the Sangha. And yeah, the seeds get watered and they come out as songs in my consciousness. So I end up writing a lot of songs while on retreat. And sometimes it's just the words first, or sometimes it's a melody or both. There's not a set way it comes, but it is founded in the practice of stopping and listening and calming. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so how do you use it as a teaching tool, especially for BIPOCs or as an edge of your teaching?
Yeah, the retreats where I've been invited to give a Dharma talk, I just say it will be a musical Dharma talk. And then it's more of a conversation of sharing where this song came from or what inspired it or what it might mean to me, or to be sharing from my own practice and insight. And then this is a song that also supports that in me. And it's just a way of sharing what has helped me in the path of healing and transformation. And hopefully it can be of support to others too.
Have you used it with the youth that you've worked with?
Oh yeah. I do a lot of music with kids. I just this summer released my fourth children's album. So I have a lot of songs that I do just for kids. Uh-huh. A lot of them are like environmental education, teach about nature and ecology. And also about the practice. On this new album, there's a When I Get Angry song. Uh-huh. When I get angry, I put my hands on my belly and breathe. And then you can substitute any like strong emotion. Uh-huh. So just, trying to share the practice with kids through music too. Mm-hmm. That's a big part of what I do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Since I did my social work master with children and mm-hmm. both preteens and then teenagers, got harder with the teenagers to on one level music was the way in for sure, but yeah. Then I was also just thinking as adults we started to tighten up. is it harder or easier, or what's your experience like in introducing music, though it does seem like such a big part of the Thich Nhat Hanh North American community kind of practice? So is there any struggles or whatever one way or the other, or ins or outs, or however you want
it to is write. it's a lot easier to sing with and for kids, because most kids are able to just be in the present moment without thinking too much and without having too many filters, and to just access joy. And so they help me get in touch with that part of myself, the inner child in me that wants to come out and play, that I might filter out, you know, and be too serious with. So it's a mutual practice of cultivating joy, singing with kids. Mm. And then with adults, that can happen, but it does require the adults to be in a place of more openness. Mm. And sometimes the music can help that happen. Certainly on a retreat, people are much more open. Sometimes singing out in public, it can be hard to gauge, you know, like I might be singing for an adult audience and it looks like people are miserable, like just having the worst time. But then afterwards they're like, oh my God, that was wonderful. I loved it. Like, really? Cause you look like you were just suffering, but it's hard to know, you know, but with the kids, it's just, they're either with you or you've lost them. And that's also a really good teaching opportunity of like, okay, I'm not connecting with them somehow. So it's a reminder to make an adjustment.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. And then I really want to ask, because I just came back from the Colombia and into the Amazon, and also heard about the Zenu people there. And I apologize, I can't remember the word for the flute that they have. The Gold Museum in Cartagena had a whole program around how these flutes, in relation, we can't frame it in the Western sense of harmony, or I don't know enough about music now to relate. And because for the Zenu people, it is very much about communicating not just with each other, but with the environment and the earth and the birds and the water. Mm-hmm. And so is there any kind of your Native American ancestry reflected in your music or your practice or in any way, your teachings?
Oh, yeah. That's all a part of me. Mm-hmm. I sang for a number of years with an intertribal Native drum group, mm-hmm. and that was a big learning. The role of being a singer in the Native community, of being of service to the community, of, again, singing as a spiritual practice, mm-hmm. and a way to connect with something greater than myself. Mm-hmm. And that is definitely a big part of all my music and songs. So it informs every song I do. But some are more specifically in that intertribal style of singing, where I sing with vocables without words, mm-hmm. Or in the Native language, which those songs for me are in Anishinaabemowin, the language of the people in this area in the Great Lakes, mm-hmm. the Anishinaabe. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then in terms of my teaching, that as well. I mean, it's just part of who I am and part of my spirituality and path and practice. So that's part of, the way that I teach too.
Mm-hmm. And, we hear a lot, or I've heard a lot, about how there might be similarity in Buddhism and Christianity, or Taoism. Is there anything you want to share about the relationship of your Choctaw and Cherokee spirituality that you think has resonance with Buddhism?
Yeah. And I mean, my Native identity is less tribal. It's more pan-Indian. And I think that is a result of growing up. Yeah, I didn't grow up in a specific tribal community. I grew up in Kalamazoo, which is a small city, so a small urban Indian community, and then here in Detroit, which is a bigger urban Indian community, which is intertribal. And so I don't claim to know like Cherokee or Choctaw specific spirituality. Mm-hmm. But in terms of just Native spirituality and even within that, there's so many different cultures and variations, but there is a general understanding of our deep interrelationship with all beings, and looking at the plants and animals and water and rocks as relatives, mm-hmm. Understanding that we're all related, mm-hmm. and that's very much the same understanding as interbeing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so for me, there's a real strong commonality there, mm-hmm. of looking at the world through the lens of interbeing, through the lens of spiritual relatives, rather than kind of a human centric or dominant way of looking at the world. Mm-hmm.
And I really appreciate you bringing up the when you were talking about your identity as and experience as pan-tribal, because as an mm-hmm. adoptee, mm-hmm. I kind of like I always say, well, ethnically I'm Vietnamese American, but I've always framed it as politics, but I would really say as an overall identity, I'm Asian American, because mm-hmm. it is this whole pan-Asian, and again, plenty of different Asians. So, you know, yeah. So you can't really say exactly. And yet there is some sense. And so when you said that, I was like, oh, yeah, I can relate to that. And that, and both the pain and the suffering and the joy of that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Of not having the specificity and yet also the resonance with the vastness of a cultural relationship, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And growing up in Michigan and living here most of my life, like this is Anishinaabe land, and those are the teachings I'm most familiar with, are Anishinaabe teachings, in terms of Native teachings, because that's, you know, that's the land that I'm in, and that's the way that things are done here.
Yeah. You know, I lived in Seattle for a while and was much more connected activism wise. And so was involved with the Native American community up there a little bit, and also worked with the Indian Child Welfare Act. Right. So understanding about how, you know, the dominant Euro sense of family is very different, you know, it's like the nuclear family versus a sense of family as more extended. And I think there is also, because of the history of being taken away from your family, your land, your community, and being displaced, there is also within the many Native communities, indigenous communities of North America, that there is this opening up, you know, yes, you might be originally from a different nation or tribe, and there is a very much a pan, you know, Indian community, because, that's a connection there.
Yeah, and both are true, and they don't have to be mutually exclusive either. Yeah. And each person's experience may be different of that, too. Uh-huh. But I only know my own.
Yeah. It's interesting, and my skin is tingling, because I'm like, hey, wait, that could be a framing, like, you know, not that I want to just say it to white people, but it's like, hey, that's a way that you can understand it. Like, you know, we all have our individual thing, and we all have been displaced by fucking white supremacy culture. And our interconnection is the sense that we have commonality, you know, and we're trying to expand the sense of commonality. We're not limiting. In fact, we've been limited, and our freedom is to expand. And accept each other as family, bigger and bigger and bigger.
And I think our survival is dependent on that as a species,
including expanding exactly that more than humans, that we're interrelated to all beings.
Yeah.
All right. Anything more you'd like to say before we end, including if it's another song?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do another song to end. How about that?
Lovely. Thank you.
This was from my third children's album, and it's called Miigwech, which means thank you in Anishinaabe Mohen.
Lovely.
So it's a simple, like, thank you song. Miigwech in Mishomis. Miigwech in Okemos, Miigwech in Shkakamekwe, Miigwech in Nibi, Miigwech in Nemishomisak, Miigwech in Nomnokomisak, Miigwech in Shkakamekwe, Miigwech in Nibi. Thank you, Grandmother. Thank you, Mother Earth. Thank you, Water. Thank you, Grandfathers. Thank you, Grandmothers. Thank you, Mother Earth. Thank you, Water. Hey,
Thank you, Grandfather. Thank you, Grandmother. Thank you, Mother Earth. Thank you, Water. Thank you, Grandfathers. Thank you, Grandmothers. Thank you, Mother Earth. Thank you, Water.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Thank you.
Oh, it's been a great honor to make your acquaintance, even under these circumstances.
Yeah, you too.
Yeah. And thank you very much for sharing yourself and your song and your Dharma with us.
Thanks for inviting me. Thank you, Reverend Leanne. And thank you, Sister Peace.
Yes.
Sending lots of love.
Yes, sending lots of love her way and her sister's way. And all beings. This has been your host for this episode, Reverend Leanne, for Opening Dharma Access with Joe Riley, sharing their Dharma experience as a BIPOC teacher. Look for Lama Karma Yeshe Children, Sister Peace, and Dalila Bothwell, the other co-hosts, as they share their discussions with more teachers in the coming months. Look for new episodes on the first Tuesday of every month. In between episodes, we'll also share a meditation, mindfulness practice, chant, song, or another form of practice from our guests with you. Come back to check that out and to keep on listening to our BIPOC teachers. Be sure to subscribe for notifications and rate and review the podcast to help us spread the word. Check the episode notes for resources and email us at suddenleap.z@gmail.com with any questions. Let's open Dharma Access to all beings.